Side 3. Count Zero by William Gibson. Continuing on page 74. She laughed, taking her eyes from the traffic. He was grinning, his mouth bracketed in deep vertical grooves. While I walked here, I imagined a structure, a machine so large that I am incapable of seeing it, a machine that surrounds me, anticipating my every step.
And you are an egotist as well?
Am I?
Perhaps not. Certainly you are observed. We watch, and it is well that we do. Your friend in the brasserie, we watch him as well. Unfortunately, we've been unable to determine where he obtained the hologram he showed you. Very likely he already had it when he began to phone your friend's number. Someone got to him, do you understand? Someone has put him in your way. Don't you think that this is most intriguing? Doesn't it pique the philosopher in you?
Yes, I suppose it does. I took the advice you gave me in the brasserie and agreed to his price.
Then he will double it.
Paco smiled. Which is of no importance to me, as you pointed out. He has agreed to contact me tomorrow. I assume that you can arrange the delivery of the money. He asked for cash.
Cash?
He rolled his eyes.
How risque.
But, yes, I can. And I know the details as well. We were monitoring the conversation. Not difficult, as he was helpful enough to broadcast it himself from a bead microphone. We were anxious to learn who that broadcast was intended for, but we doubt he knows that himself. It was unlike him, she said, frowning, to excuse himself, to break off that way, before he had made his demands. He fancies he has a flair for the dramatic moment.
He had no choice, Paco said. We engineered what he took to be a failure of the bead's power source. It required a trip to the Om, then. He said very nasty things about you, alone in the cubicle.
She gestured to her empty glass as a waiter passed. I still find it difficult to see my part in this, my value. To Virek, I mean.
Don't ask me. You are the philosopher here. I merely execute Senor's orders, to the best of my ability.
Would you like a brandy, Paco? Or perhaps some coffee?
The French, he said, with great conviction, know nothing about coffee.
13. With both hands. Maybe you can run that one by me again, Bobby said, around a mouthful of rice and eggs. I thought you already said it's not a religion.
Beauvoir removed his eyeglass frames and sighted down one of the earpieces. That wasn't what I said. I said you didn't have to worry about it, is all, whether it's a religion or not. It's just a structure. Let's you and me discuss some things that are happening. Otherwise, we might not have words for it. Concepts.
But you talk like these, what you call them, lows, are...
Loa, Beauvoir corrected, tossing his glasses down on the table.
He sighed, dug one of the Chinese cigarettes from Tuaday's pack, and lit it with the pewter skull.
Plurals same as the singular.
He inhaled deeply, blew out twin streams of smoke through arched nostrils.
You think religion? What are you thinking about exactly?
Well, my mother's sister, she's a Scientologist, real orthodox, you know. And there's this woman across the hall, she's Catholic. My old lady.
He paused, the food gone tasteless in his mouth.
She'd put these holograms up in my room sometimes, Jesus or Hubbard or some shit. I guess I think about that.
Vaudou isn't like that, Beauvoir said. It isn't concerned with notions of salvation and transcendence. What it's about is getting things done. You follow me? In our system, there are many gods, spirits, part of one big family, with all the virtues, all the vices. There's a ritual tradition of communal manifestation, understand? Vaudou says there's God, sure, Grand Met, but he's big and too far away to worry himself if your ass is poor or you can't get laid. Come on, man, you know how this works. It's street religion. Came out of a dirt-poor place a million years ago. Vodou's like the street. Some duster chops out your sister. You don't go camp on the Yakuza's doorstep, do you? No way. You go to somebody, though, who can get the thing done, right?
Bobby nodded, chewing thoughtfully. Another derm and two glasses of the red wine had helped a lot, and the big man had taken two a day for a walk through the trees and the fluorescent jackstraws, leaving Bobby with Beauvoir. Then Jackie had shown up all cheerful with a big bowl of this eggs and rice stuff, which wasn't bad at all, and as she'd put it down on the table in front of him, she'd pressed one of her tits against his shoulder.
So, Beauvoir said, we are concerned with getting things done. If you want, we're concerned with systems, and so are you, or at least you want to be, or else you wouldn't be a cowboy and you wouldn't have a handle, right?
He dunked what was left of the cigarette in a fingerprinted glass half full of red wine. Looks like Two-A-Day was about to get down to serious partying about the time the shit hit the fan.
What shit's that? Bobby asked, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
You, Beauvoir said, frowning.
Not that any of it is your fault, as much as Two-A-Day wants to make out that's the case.
He does. He seems pretty tense now. Real bitchy, too.
Exactly. You got it. Tense. Scared shitless is more like it.
So how come?
Well, you see, things aren't exactly what they seem with Two-A-Day. I mean, yeah, he actually does the kind of shit you've known him to. Hustles hot software to the Caspers, pardon me. He grinned. Down in Berrytown. But his main shot, I mean the man's real ambitions, you understand, lie elsewhere.
Beauvoir picked up a wilted canapé, regarded it with evident suspicion, and flicked it over the table into the trees.
His thing, you understand, is dicking around for a couple of big-time sprawl ungots.
Bobby nodded blankly.
Dudes who serve with both hands.
You lost me there.
We're talking a professional priesthood here, you want to call it that. Otherwise, just imagine a couple of major dudes, console cowboys, among other things, who make it their business to get things done for people. To serve with both hands is an expression we have. Sort of means they work both ends. White and black, got me.
Bobby swallowed, then shook his head.
Sorcerers, Beauvoir said. Never mind. Bad dudes, big money. That's all you need to know. Two-A-Day, he acts like an upline Joe boy for these people. Sometimes he finds something they might be interested in. He downloads it on them, collects a few favors later. Maybe he collects a dozen too many favors. They download something on him. Not quite the same proposition, you follow me? Say they get something they think has potential, but it scares them. These characters tend to a certain conservatism, you see. No? Well, you'll learn.
Bobby nodded.
The kind of software someone like you would rent from Two-A-Day, that's nothing. I mean, it'll work, but it's nothing anybody heavy would ever bother with. You've seen a lot of cowboy kinos, right? Well, the stuff they make up for those things isn't much, compared with the kind of shit a real heavy operator confront. Particularly when it comes to icebreakers. Heavy icebreakers are kind of funny to deal in, even for the big boys. You know why? Because ice, all the really hard stuff, the walls around every major store of data in the Matrix, is always the produce of an AI, an artificial intelligence. Nothing else is fast enough to weave good ice and constantly alter and upgrade it. So when a really powerful icebreaker shows up on the black market, there are already a couple of very dicey factors in play. Like for starts, where did the product come from? 9 times out of 10, it came from an AI. And AIs are constantly screened, mainly by the Turing people, to make sure they don't get too smart. So maybe you'll get the Turing machine after your ass, because maybe an AI somewhere wants to augment its private cash flow. Some AIs have citizenship, right? Another thing you have to watch out for, maybe it's a military icebreaker, and that's bad heat too. Or maybe it's taken a walk out of some Zaibatsu's industrial espionage arm, and you don't want that either. You taking this shit in, Bobby?
Bobby nodded. He felt like he'd been waiting all his life to hear Beauvoir explain the workings of a world whose existence he'd only guessed at before.
Still, An icebreaker that'll really cut is worth mega. I mean, beaucoup.
So maybe you're Mr. Big in the market. Someone offers you this thing, and you don't want to just tell them to take a walk. So you buy it. You buy it real quiet, but you don't slot it, no. What do you do with it? You take it home. Have your tech fix it up so that it looks real average. Like you have it set up in a format like this. And he tapped a stack of software in front of him. And you take it to your Joe boy, who owes you some favors, as usual.
Wait a sec, Bobby said. I don't think I like good.
That means you're getting smart, or anyway smarter, because that's what they did. They brought it out here to your friendly wareman, Mr. Two-A-Day, and they told him their problem. Ace, they say, we want to check this shit out, test drive it, but no way we gonna do it ourselves. It's down to you, boy. So, in the way of things, what's Two-A-Day gonna do with it? Is he gonna slot it? No way at all. He just does the same damn thing the big boys did to him, except he isn't even going to bother telling the guy he's going to do it to. What he does, he picks a base out in the Midwest that's full of tax dodge programs and yen laundry flowcharts for some whorehouse in Kansas City. And everybody who didn't just fall off a tree knows that the motherfucker is eyeball deep in ice, black ice, totally lethal feedback programs. There isn't a cowboy in the sprawl or out who'd mess with that base. First, because it's dripping with defenses. Second, because the stuff inside isn't worth anything to anybody but the IRS, and they're probably already on the owner's take.
Hey, Bobby said, let me get this straight. I'm giving it to you straight, white boy. He picked out that base, then he ran down his list of hot doggers, ambitious punks from over in Berrytown, Wilsons dumb enough to run a program they'd never seen before, against a base that some joker like Two-A-Day fingered for them and told them was an easy make. And who's he pick? He picks somebody new to the game, Natch, somebody who doesn't even know where he lives, doesn't even have his number. And he says, here, my man, you take this home and make yourself some money. You get anything good, I'll fence it for you.
Beauvoir's eyes were wide. He wasn't smiling. Sound like anybody you know, man? Or maybe you try not to hang out with losers.
You mean he knew I was going to get killed if I plugged into that base?
No, Bobby, but he knew it was a possibility if the package didn't work. What he mainly wanted was to watch you try, which he didn't bother to do himself, just put a couple of cowboys on it. It could have gone a couple different ways. Say, if that icebreaker had done its number on the black ice, you'd have gotten in, found a bunch of figures that meant dick to you. You'd have gotten back out, maybe without leaving any trace at all. Well, you'd have come back to Leon's and told Two-A-Day that he'd fingered the wrong data. Oh, he'd have been real apologetic, for sure. And you'd have gotten a new target and a new icebreaker, and he'd have taken the first one back to the sprawl and said it looked okay. Meanwhile, he'd have an eye cocked in your direction, just to monitor your health, make sure nobody came looking for the icebreaker they might have heard you'd used. Another way it might have gone, the way it nearly did go, something could have been funny with the icebreaker. The ice could have fried you dead, and one of those cowboys would have had to break into your mama's place and get that software back before anybody found your body.
I don't know, Beauvoir. That's pretty fucking hard to...
Hard my ass. Life is hard. I mean, we're talking biz, you know? Beauvoir regarded him with some severity, the plastic frames far down his slender nose. He was lighter than either Two-A-Day or the big man, the color of coffee with only a little whitener, his forehead high and smooth beneath close-cropped black frizz. He looked skinny under his gray sharkskin robe, and Bobby didn't really find him threatening at all. But our problem, the reason we're here, the reason you're here, is to figure out what did happen. And that's something else.
But you mean he set me up? Two-A-Day set me up so I'd get my ass killed?
Bobby was still in the St. Mary's maternity wheelchair, although he no longer felt like he needed it. And he's in deep shit with these guys, these heavies from the sprawl? You got it now. And that's why he was acting that way, like he doesn't give a shit, or maybe hates my guts, right? And he's real scared? Beauvoir nodded. And, Bobby said, suddenly seeing what Two-A-Day was really pissed about, and why he was scared. It's because I got my ass jumped down by Big Playground, and those Loeb fucks ripped me from my deck. And their software, it was still in my deck. He leaned forward, excited at having put it together. And these guys, it's like they'll kill him or something, unless he gets it back for them, right? I can tell you watch a lot of Kino, Beauvoir said. But that's about the size of it, definitely. Right, Bobby said, settling back in the wheelchair and putting his bare feet up on the edge of the table. Well, Beauvoir, who are these guys? What you call 'em, hoon guns? Sorcerers, you said. What the fuck's that supposed to mean? Well, Bobby, Beauvoir said, I'm one, and the big fella, you can call him Lucas. He's the other. You've probably seen one of these before, Beauvoir said, as the man he called Lucas put the projection tank down on the table, having methodically cleared a place for it. In school, Bobby said. You go to school, man? Two-a-day snapped. Why the fuck didn't you stay there? He'd been chain-smoking since he came back with Lucas, and seemed in worse shape than he'd been in before. Shut up, Two-a-day, Beauvoir said. Little education might do you some good. They used one to teach us our way around in the Matrix, how to access stuff from the print library, like that. Well then, Lucas said, straightening up and brushing non-existent dust from his big pink palms. Did you ever use it for that, to access print books? He'd removed his immaculate black suit coat. His spotless white shirt was traversed by a pair of slender maroon suspenders, and he'd loosened the knot of his plain black tie. I don't read too well, Bobby said. I mean, I can, but it's work. But yeah, I did. I looked at some real old books on the Matrix and stuff. I thought you had, Lucas said, jacking some kind of small deck into the console that formed the base of the tank. Count zero. Count zero interrupt. Old programmer talk. He passed the deck to Beauvoir, who began to tap commands into it. Complex geometric forms began to click into place in the tank, aligned with the nearly invisible planes of a three-dimensional grid. Beauvoir was sketching in the cyberspace coordinates for Barrytown, Bobby saw. We'll call you this Blue Pyramid, Bobby. There you are. A blue pyramid began to pulse softly at the very center of the tank. Now we'll show you what Two-a-Day's cowboys saw, the ones who were watching you. From now on, you're seeing a recording. An interrupted line of blue light extruded from the pyramid, following a grid line. Bobby watched, seeing himself alone in his mother's living room, the Ono Sendai on his lap, the curtains drawn, his fingers moving across the deck. Icebreaker on its way, Beauvoir said. The line of blue dots reached the wall of the tank. Beauvoir tapped the deck, and the coordinates changed. A new set of geometrics replaced the first arrangement. Bobby recognized the cluster of orange rectangles centered in the grid. That's it, he said. The blue line progressed from the edge of the tank, headed for the orange base. Faint planes of ghost orange flickered around the rectangles, shifting and strobing as the line grew closer. You can see something's wrong right there, Lucas said. That's their ice, and it was already hip to you. Rumbled you before you even got a lock. As the line of blue dots touched the shifting orange plane, it was surrounded by a translucent orange tube of slightly greater diameter. The tube began to lengthen, traveling back along the line, until it reached the wall of the tank. Meanwhile, Beauvoir said, back home in Barrytown. He tapped the deck again, and now Bobby's blue pyramid was in the center. Bobby watched as the orange tube emerged from the wall of the projection tank, still following the blue line, and smoothly approached the pyramid. Now at this point you were due to start doing some serious dying, cowboy. The tube reached the pyramid. Triangular orange planes snapped up, walling it in. Beauvoir froze the projection. Now, Lucas said, when Two-a-Day's hired help, who are all in all a pair of tough and experienced console jockeys, When they saw what you are about to see, my man, they decided that their deck was due for that big overhaul in the sky. Being pros, they had a backup deck. When they brought it online, they saw the same thing. It was at that point that they decided to phone their employer, Mr. Tuaday, who, as we can see from this mess, was about to throw himself a party.
Man, Tuaday said, his voice tight with hysteria, I told you. I had some clients up here needed entertaining. I paid those boys to watch, they were watching, and they phoned me. I phoned you. What the hell you want, anyway?
Our property, Beauvoir said softly. Now watch this, real close. This motherfucker is what we call an anomalous phenomenon. No shit. He tapped the deck again, starting the recording. Liquid flowers of milky white blossomed from the floor of the tank. Bobby, craning forward, saw that they seemed to consist of thousands of tiny spheres or bubbles, and then they aligned perfectly with the cubical grid and coalesced, forming a top-heavy asymmetrical structure, a thing like a rectangular mushroom. The surfaces, facets, were white, perfectly blank. The image in the tank was no longer than Bobby's open hand, but to anyone jacked into a deck it would have been enormous. The thing unfolded a pair of horns. These lengthened, curved, became pincers that arced out to grasp the pyramid. He saw the tips sink smoothly through the flickering orange planes of the enemy ice. She said, What are you doing? He heard himself say. Then she asked me why they were doing that, doing it to me, killing me.
Ah, Beauvoir said quietly. Now we are getting somewhere.
He didn't know where they were going, but he was glad to be out of that chair. Beauvoir ducked to avoid a slanting grow light that dangled from twin lengths of curly cord. Bobby followed, almost slipping in a green-filmed puddle of water. Away from Tuaday's couch clearing, the air seemed thicker. There was a greenhouse smell of damp and growing things. So that's how it was, Beauvoir said. Tuaday sent some friends round to Covina Concourse Courts, but you were gone. Your deck was gone, too.
Well, Bobby said, I don't see it's exactly his fault, then. I mean, if I hadn't split for Leon's, and I was looking for Tuaday, even looking to try to get up here, then he'd have found me, right?
Beauvoir paused to admire a leafy stand of flowering hemp, extending a thin brown forefinger to lightly brush the pale colorless flowers.
True, he said, but this is a business matter. He should have detailed someone to watch your place for the duration of the run, to ensure that neither you nor the software took any unscheduled walks.
Well, he sent Rhea and Jackie over to Leon's, because I saw him there. Bobby reached into the neck of his black pajamas and scratched at the sealed wound that crossed his chest and stomach. Then he remembered the centipede thing Pi had used as a suture, and quickly withdrew his hand. It itched, a straight line of itch, but he didn't want to touch it. No, Jackie and Rhea are ours. Jackie is a Mambo, a priestess, the horse of Danbala.
Beauvoir continued on his way, picking out what Bobby presumed was some existing track or path through the jumbled forest of hydroponics, although it seemed to progress in no particular direction. Some of the larger shrubs were rooted in bulbous green plastic trash bags filled with dark humus. Many of these had burst, and pale roots sought fresh nourishment in the shadows between the grow lights, where time and the gradual fall of leaves conspired to produce a thin compost. Bobby wore a pair of black nylon thongs Jackie had found for him, but there was already damp earth between his toes.
A horse? He asked Beauvoir, dodging past a prickly-looking thing that suggested an inside-out palm tree.
Danbala rides her. Danbala Wado, the snake. Other times she is the horse of Aida Wado, his wife.
Bobby decided not to pursue it. He tried to change the subject.
How come Tuaday's got such a mother-huge place? What are all these trees and things for?
He knew that Jackie and Rhea had wheeled him through a doorway in the St. Mary's chair, but he hadn't seen a wall since. He also knew that the arcology covered X number of hectares, so that it was possible that Tuaday's place was very large indeed, but it hardly seemed likely that a wareman, even a very sharp one, could afford this much space. Nobody could afford this much space, and why would anybody want to live in a leaky hydroponic forest? The last derm was wearing off, and his back and chest were beginning to burn and ache. Ficus trees, mapu trees, this whole level of the project is a lieu saint, holy place. Beauvoir tapped Bobby on the shoulder and pointed out twisted bicolored strings dangling from the limbs of a nearby tree. The trees are consecrated to different loa. That one is for Ugu, Ugu Ferre, god of war. There's a lot of other things grown up here, herbs the leaf doctors need, and some just for fun. But this isn't two-a-day's place. This is communal.
You mean the whole project's into this? All like voodoo and stuff?
It was worse than Marcia's darkest fantasies. No, man, and Beauvoir laughed. There's a mosque up top, and a couple are 10,000 Holy Roller Baptists scattered around, some church asai, all the usual stuff. Still, he grinned, we are the ones with the tradition of getting shit done. But how this got started, this level, that goes way back. The people who designed these places, maybe 80, 100 years ago, they had the idea they'd make them as self-sufficient as possible. Make them grow food. Make them heat themselves, generate power, whatever. Now this one, you drill far enough down, is sitting on top of a lot of geothermal water. It's real hot down there, but not hot enough to run an engine, so it wasn't going to give them any power. They made a stab at power up on the roof, with about 100 Darius rotors. What they call egg beaters. Had themselves a wind farm, see? Today they get most of their watts off the fission authority, like anybody else. But that geothermal water, they pump that up to a heat exchanger. It's too salty to drink, so in the exchanger it just heats up your standard Jersey tap water, which a lot of people figure isn't worth drinking anyway. Finally, they were approaching a wall of some kind. Bobby looked back. Shallow pools on the muddy concrete floor caught and reflected the limbs of the dwarf trees, the bare pale roots straggling down into makeshift tanks of hydroponic fluid. Then they pump that into shrimp tanks and grow a lot of shrimp. Shrimp grow real fast in warm water. Then they pump it through pipes in the concrete up here to keep this place warm. That's what this level was for, to grow ponic amaranth, lettuce, things like that. Then they pump it out into the catfish tanks, and algae eat the shrimp shit. Catfish eat the algae, and it all goes round again. Or anyway, that was the idea. Chances are they didn't figure anybody'd go up on the roof and kick those Darius rotors over to make room for a mosque, and they didn't figure a lot of other changes either. So we wound up with this space. But you can still get you some damned good shrimp in the project. Catfish, too. They had arrived at the wall. It was made of glass, beaded heavily with condensation. A few centimeters beyond it was another wall, that one made of what looked like rusty sheet steel. Beauvoir fished a key of some kind from a pocket in his shark-skin robe and slid it into an opening in a bare alloy beam dividing two expanses of window. Somewhere nearby, an engine whined into life. The broad steel shutter rotated up and out, moving jerkily, to reveal a view that Bobby had often imagined. They must be near the top, high up in the projects, because Big Playground was something he could cover with two hands. The condos of Berrytown looked like some gray-white fungus spreading to the horizon. It was nearly dark, and he could make out a pink glow beyond the last range of condo racks. That's the sprawl over there, isn't it? That pink. That's right. But the closer you get, the less pretty it looks. How'd you like to go there, Bobby? Count zero ready to make the sprawl? Oh, yeah, Bobby said, his palms against the sweating glass. You got no idea. The derm had worn off entirely now, and his back and chest hurt like hell. 14. Night Flight. As the night came on, Turner found the edge again. It seemed like a long time since he'd been there, but when it clicked in, it was like he'd never left. It was that superhuman synchromesh flow that stimulants only approximated. He could only score for it on the site of a major defection, one where he was in command, and then only in the final hours before the actual move. But it had been a long time. In New Delhi, he'd only been checking out possible escape routes for an executive who wasn't entirely certain that relocation was what he wanted. If he had been working the edge that night in Chandni Chowk, maybe he'd have been able to dodge the thing. Probably not, but the edge would have told him to try. Now the edge let him collate the factors he had to deal with at the site, balancing clusters of small problems against single larger ones. So far there were a lot of little ones, but no real ball breakers. Lynch and Weber were starting to get in each other's hair, so he arranged to keep them apart. His conviction that Lynch was Conroy's plant, instinctive from the beginning, was stronger now. Instincts sharpened on the edge. Things got witchy. Nathan was having trouble with the low-tech Swedish hand warmers. Anything short of an electronic circuit baffled him. Turner put Lynch to work on the hand warmers, fueling and priming them, and let Nathan carry them out, two at a time, and bury them shallowly, at meter intervals, along the two long lines of orange tape. The Microsoft Conroy had sent filled his head with its own universe of constantly shifting factors. Airspeed, altitude, attitude, angle of attack, G-forces, headings. The plane's weapon delivery information was a constant subliminal litany of target designators, bomb fall lines, search circles, range and release cues, weapons counts. Conroy had tagged the Microsoft with a simple message outlining the plane's time of arrival and confirming the arrangement for space for a single passenger. He wondered what Mitchell was doing, feeling. The Mass Biolabs North America facility was carved into the heart of a sheer mesa, a table of rock thrusting from the desert floor. The Biosoft dossier had shown Turner the mesa's face, cut with bright evening windows. It rode about the uplifted arms of a sea of saguaros, like the wheelhouse of a giant ship. To Mitchell, it had been prison and fortress, his home for 9 years. Somewhere near its core, he had perfected the hybridoma technique that had eluded other researchers for almost a century. Working with human cancer cells and a neglected, nearly forgotten model of DNA synthesis, he had produced the immortal hybrid cells that were the basic production tools of the new technology, minute biochemical factories endlessly reproducing the engineered molecules that were linked and built up into biochips. Somewhere in the Mass Arcology, Mitchell would be moving through his last hours as their star researcher. Turner tried to imagine Mitchell leading a very different sort of life following his defection to Hosaka, but found it difficult. Was a research arcology in Arizona very different from one on Honshu? There had been times during that long day when Mitchell's coded memories had risen in him, filling him with a strange dread that seemed to have nothing to do with the operation at hand. It was the intimacy of the thing that still disturbed him. And perhaps the feeling of fear sprang from that. Certain fragments seemed to have an emotional power entirely out of proportion to their content. Why should a memory of a plain hallway in some dingy Cambridge graduate dormitory fill him with a sense of guilt and self-loathing? Other images, which logically should have carried a degree of feeling, were strangely lacking in affect. Mitchell playing with his baby daughter on an expanse of pale woolen broadloom in a rented house in Geneva. The child laughing, tugging at his hand. Nothing. The man's life, from Turner's vantage, seemed marked out by a certain inevitability. He was brilliant, a brilliance that had been detected early on, highly motivated, gifted at the kind of blandly ruthless in-company manipulation required by someone who aspired to become a top research scientist. If anyone was destined to rise through laboratory corporate hierarchies, Turner decided, it would be Mitchell. Turner himself was incapable of meshing with the intensely tribal world of the Zaibatsu men, the lifers. He was a perpetual outsider, a rogue factor adrift on the secret seas of intercorporate politics. No company man would have been capable of taking the initiatives Turner was required to take in the course of an extraction. No company man was capable of Turner's professionally casual ability to realign his loyalties to fit a change in employers. or perhaps of his unyielding commitment once a contract had been agreed upon. He had drifted into security work in his late teens, when the grim doldrums of the post-war economy were giving way to the impetus of new technologies. He had done well in security, considering his general lack of ambition. He had a ropey, muscular poise that impressed his employer's clients, and he was bright, very bright. He wore clothes well. He had a way with technology. Conroy had found him in Mexico, where Turner's employer had contracted to provide security for a SenseNet SimStim team who were recording a series of 30-minute segments in an ongoing jungle adventure series. When Conroy arrived, Turner was finishing his assignments. He'd set up a liaison between SenseNet and the local government, bribed the town's top police official, analyzed the hotel's security system, met the local guides and drivers, and had their histories double-checked, arranged for digital voice protection on the SimStim team's transceivers, established a crisis management team, and planted seismic sensors around the SenseNet suite cluster. He entered the hotel's bar, a jungle garden extension of the lobby, and found a seat by himself at one of the glass-topped tables. A pale man with a shock of white bleached hair crossed the bar with a drink in each hand. The pale skin was drawn tight across angular features and a high forehead. He wore a neatly pressed military shirt over jeans and leather sandals. "You're the security for those SimStim kids," the pale man said, putting one of the drinks down on Turner's table. "Alfredo told me." Alfredo was one of the hotel bartenders. Turner looked up at the man, who was evidently sober and seemed to have all the confidence in the world. "I don't think we've been introduced," Turner said, making no move to accept the proffered drink. "It doesn't matter," Conroy said, seating himself. "We're in the same ball game." He seated himself. Turner stared. He had a bodyguard's presence, something restless and watchful written in the lines of his body, and few strangers would so casually violate his private space. "You know," the man said, the way someone might comment on a team that wasn't doing particularly well in a given season, "those seismics you're using really don't make it. I've met people who could walk in there, eat your kids for breakfast, stack the bones in the shower, and stroll out whistling. Those seismics would say it never happened." He took a sip of his drink. "You get A for effort, though. You know how to do a job." The phrase, "stack the bones in the shower," was enough. Turner decided to take the pale man out. "Look, Turner, here's your leading lady." The man smiled up at Jane Hamilton, who smiled back, her wide blue eyes clear and perfect, each iris ringed with the minute gold lettering of the Zeiss icon logo. Turner froze, caught in a split-second lock of indecision. The star was close, too close, and the pale man was rising. "Nice meeting you, Turner," he said. "We'll get together sooner or later. Take my advice about those seismics. Back 'em up with a perimeter of screamers." And then he turned and walked away, muscles rolling easily beneath the crisp fabric of his tan shirt. "That's nice, Turner," Hamilton said, taking the stranger's place.
"Yeah?"
Turner watched as the man was lost in the confusion of the crowded lobby, amid pink-fleshed tourists.
"You don't ever seem to talk to people. You always look like you're running a make on them, filing a report. It's nice to see you making friends for a change."
Turner looked at her. She was 20, 4 years his junior, and earned roughly 9 times his annual salary in a given week. She was blonde, her hair cropped short for the series role, deeply tanned, and looked as if she was illuminated from within by sun lamps. The blue eyes were inhumanly perfect optical instruments, grown in vats in Japan. She was both actress and camera, her eyes worth several million new yen, and in the hierarchy of SenseNet stars, she barely rated. He sat with her in the bar until she'd finished 2 drinks, then walked her back to the suite cluster.
"You wouldn't feel like coming in for another, would you, Turner?"
"No," he said. This was the second evening she'd made the offer, and he sensed that it would be the last. "I have to check the seismics." Later that night, he phoned New York for the number of a firm in Mexico City that could supply him with screamers for the perimeter of the sweet cluster. But a week later, Jane and three others, half the series cast, were dead. "We're ready to roll the medics," Weber said. Turner saw that she was wearing fingerless brown leather gloves. She replaced her sunglasses with clear glass shooting glasses, and there was a pistol on her hip. "Sutcliffe's monitoring the perimeter with the remotes. We'll need everybody else to get the fucker through the brush."
"Need me?"
"Ramirez says he can't do anything too strenuous this close to jacking in. You ask me, he's just a lazy little L.A. shit."
"No," Turner said, getting up from his seat on the ledge. "He's right. If he sprained his wrist, we'd be screwed. Even something so minor that he couldn't feel it could affect his speed."
Weber shrugged.
"Yeah.
Well, he's back in the bunker, bathing his hands in the last of our water and humming to himself, so we should be just fine."
When they reached the surgery, Turner automatically counted heads. 7. Ramirez was in the bunker. Sutcliffe was somewhere in the cinderblock maze, monitoring the sentry remotes. Lynch had a Steiner optic laser slung over his right shoulder, a compact model with a folding alloy skeleton stock, integral batteries forming a fat hand grip below the gray titanium housing that served the thing as a barrel. Nathan was wearing a black jumpsuit, black paratrooper boots filmed with pale dust, and had the bulbous anti-goggles of an image amplification rig dangling below his chin on a head strap. Turner removed his Mexican sunglasses, tucked them into a breast pocket in the blue work shirt, and buttoned the flap.
"How's it going, Teddy?" he asked a beefy six-footer with close-cropped brown hair.
"Just fine," Teddy said, with a toothy smile.
Turner surveyed the other three members of the psych team, nodding to each man in turn. Compton, Costa, Davis.
"Getting down to the wire, huh?" Costa asked. He had a round, moist face and a thin, carefully trimmed beard. Like Nathan and the others, he wore black.
"Pretty close," Turner said.
"All smooth so far."
Costa nodded.
"We're an estimated 30 minutes from arrival," Turner said.
"Nathan, Davis," Weber said, "disconnect the sewage line."
She handed Turner one of the Telefunken earbead sets. She'd already removed it from its bubble pack. She put one on herself, peeling the plastic backing from the self-adhesive throat microphone and smoothing it into place on her sunburnt neck. Nathan and Davis were moving in the shadows behind the module. Turner heard Davis curse softly.
"Shit," Nathan said. "There's no cap for the end of the tube."
The others laughed.
"Leave it," Weber said. "Get to work on the wheels. Lynch and Compton unlimber the jacks."
Lynch drew a pistol-shaped power driver from his belt and ducked beneath surgery. It was swaying now, the suspension creaking softly. The medics were moving inside. Turner heard a brief high-pitched whine from some piece of internal machinery, and then the chatter of Lynch's driver as he readied the jacks. He put his earbead in and stuck the throat mic beside his larynx.
"Sutcliffe, check."
"Fine,"
the Australian said, a tiny voice that seemed to come from the base of his skull.
"Ramirez?"
"Loud and clear."
8 minutes. They were rolling the module out on its 10 fat tires. Turner and Nathan were on the front pair, steering. Nathan had his goggles on. Mitchell was coming out in the dark of the moon. The module was heavy, absurdly heavy, and very nearly impossible to steer. "Like balancing a truck on a couple of shopping carts," Nathan said to himself. Turner's lower back was giving him trouble. It hadn't been quite right since New Delhi.
"Hold it," Weber said from the third wheel on the left. "I'm stuck on a fucking rock."
Turner released his wheel and straightened up. The bats were out in force tonight, flickering things against the bowl of desert starlight. There were bats in Mexico, in the jungle, fruit bats that slept in the trees that overhung the sweet cluster where the SenseNet crew slept. Turner had climbed those trees, had strung the overhanging limbs with taut lengths of molecular monofilament,
meters of invisible razor waiting for an unwary intruder. But Jane and the others had died anyway, blown away on a hillside in the mountains near Acapulco. Trouble with a labor union, someone said later, but nothing was ever determined, really, other than the fact of the primitive claymore charge, its placement, and the position from which it had been detonated. Turner had climbed the hill himself, his clothes filmed with blood, and seen the nest of crushed undergrowth where the killers had waited, the knife switch, and the corroded automobile battery. He found the butts of hand-rolled cigarettes and the cap from a bottle of Bohemia beer, bright and new. The series had to be cancelled, and the crisis management team did yeoman duty, arranging the removal of bodies and the repatriation of the surviving members of the cast and crew. Turner was on the last plane out, and after 8 scotches in the lounge of the Acapulco airport, he'd wandered blindly out into the central ticketing area and encountered a man named Bushell, an executive tech from SenseNet's Los Angeles complex. Bushell was pale beneath an L.A. tan, his seersucker suit limp with sweat. He was carrying a plain aluminum case, like a camera case, its sides dull with condensation. Turner stared at the man, stared at the sweating case with its red and white warning decals and lengthy labels explaining the precautions required in the transportation of materials in cryogenic storage. Christ, Bushell said, noticing him. Turner, I'm sorry, man. Came down this morning. Ugly fucking business. He took a sodden handkerchief from his jacket pocket and wiped his face. Ugly job. I've never had to do one of these before. What's in the case, Bushell? He was much closer now, although he didn't remember stepping forward. He could see the pores in Bushell's tanned face. You okay, man? Bushell taking a step back. You look bad. What's in the case, Bushell? Seersucker bunched in his fist, knuckles white and shaking. Damn it, Turner! The man jerking free, the handle of the case clutched in both hands now. They weren't damaged, only some minor abrasion on one of the corneas. They belonged to the net. It was in her contract, Turner. And he turned away, his guts knotted tight around 8 glasses of straight scotch, and fought the nausea. And he'd continued to fight it, held it off for 9 years, until, in his flight from the Dutchman, all the memory of it had come down on him, had fallen on him in London, in Heathrow, and he'd leaned forward, without pausing in his progress down yet another corridor, and vomited into a blue plastic waste canister. Come on, Turner, Weber said. Put some back in it. Show us how it's done. The module began to strain forward again, through the tarry smell of the desert plants. Ready here, Ramirez said, his voice remote and calm. Turner touched the throat mic. I'm sending you some company. He removed his finger from the mic. Nathan, it's time. You and Davis, back to the bunker. Davis was in charge of the squirt gear, their sole non-matrix link with Hosaka. Nathan was Mr. Fix-It. Lynch was rolling the last of the bicycle wheels away into the brush beyond the parking lot. Weber and Compton were kneeling beside the module, attaching the line that linked the Hosaka surgeons with the Sony biomonitor in the command post. With the wheels removed, lowered and leveled on 4 jacks, the portable neurosurgery reminded Turner once again of the French vacation module. That had been a much later trip, 4 years after Conroy had recruited him in Los Angeles. How's it going? Sutcliffe asked over the link. Fine, Turner said, touching the mic. Lonely out here, Sutcliffe said. Compton, Turner said, Sutcliffe needs you to help him cover the perimeter. You too, Lynch. Too bad, Lynch said from the dark. I was hoping I'd get to see the action. Turner's hand was on the grip of the holstered Smith & Wesson under the open flap of the parka. Now, Lynch. If Lynch was Connie's plant, he'd want to be here, or in the bunker. Fuck it, Lynch said. There's nobody out there, and you know it. If you don't want me here, I'll go in there and watch Ramirez. Right. Turner said and drew the gun, depressing the stud that activated the xenon projector. The first tight beam flash of noon bright xenon light found a twisted saguaro, its needles like tufts of gray fur in the pitiless illumination. The second lit up the spiked skull on Lynch's belt, framed it in a sharp-edged circle. The sound of the shot and the sound of the bullet detonating on impact were indistinguishable, waves of concussion rolling out in invisible, ever-widening rings, out into the flat, dark land like thunder. In the first few seconds after, there was no sound at all, even the bats and bugs silenced, waiting. Weber had thrown herself flat in the scrub, and somehow he sensed her there, now, knew that her gun would be out, held dead steady in those brown, capable hands. He had no idea where Compton was. Then Sutcliffe's voice, over the earbead, scratching at him from his brain pan.
Turner, what was that?
There was enough starlight now to make out Weber. She was sitting up, gun in her hands, ready, her elbows braced on her knees. He was Conroy's plant, Turner said, lowering the Smith & Wesson.
Jesus Christ, she said. I'm Conroy's plant.
He had a line up. I've seen it before. She had to say it twice. Sutcliffe's voice in his head, and then Ramirez. We got your transportation. 80 clicks and closing. Everything else looks clear. There's a blimp 20 clicks south-southwest, Jaylene says. Unmanned cargo, and it's right on schedule. Nothing else. What the fuck's Sut yelling about? Nathan says he heard a shot. Ramirez was jacked in, most of his sensorium taken up with the input from the Mas Neotech deck. Nathan's ready with the first squirt. Turner could hear the jet banking now, braking for the landing on the highway. Weber was up and walking toward him, her gun in her hand. Sutcliffe was asking the same question over and over. He reached up and touched the throat mic. Lynch, he's dead. The jet's here. This is it. And then the jet was on them, black shadow, incredibly low, coming in without lights. There was a flare of blowback jets, as the thing executed a landing that would have killed a human pilot, and then a weird creaking as it readjusted its articulated carbon fiber airframe. Turner could make out the green reflected glow of instrumentation in the curve of the plastic canopy.
You fucked up, Weber said.
Behind her, the hatch in the side of the surgery module popped open, framing a masked figure in a green paper contamination suit. The light from inside was blue-white, brilliant. It threw a distorted shadow of the suited medic out through the thin cloud of dust that hung above the lot in the wake of the jet's landing.
Close it, Weber shouted. Not yet!
As the door swung down, shutting out the light, they both heard the ultralight's engine. After the roar of the jet, it seemed no more than the hum of a dragonfly, a drone that stuttered and faded as they listened.
He's out of fuel, Weber said, but he's close.
He's here, Turner said, pressing the throat mic. First squirt. The tiny plane whispered past them, a dark delta against the stars. They could hear something flapping in the wind of its silent passage, perhaps one of Mitchell's pants legs. You're up there, Turner thought, all alone, in the warmest clothes you own, wearing a pair of infrared goggles you built for yourself, and you're looking for a pair of dotted lines picked out for you in hand warmers.
You crazy fucker, he said, his heart filling with a strange admiration. You really want it out bad.
Then the first flare went up, with a festive little pop, and the magnesium glare began its slow white parachute ride to the desert floor. Almost immediately there were two more, and the long rattle of automatic fire from the west end of the mall. He was peripherally aware of Weber stumbling through the brush in the direction of the bunker, but his eyes were fixed on the wheeling ultralight, on its gay orange and blue fabric wings, and the goggled figure hunched there in the open metal framework above the fragile tripod landing gear. Mitchell. The lot was bright as a football field under the drifting flares. The ultralight banked and turned with a lazy grace that made Turner want to scream. A line of tracers hosed out in a white arc from beyond the sight perimeter. Missed.
Get it down! Get it down!
He was running, jumping clumps of brush that caught at his ankles, at the hem of his parka. The flares. The light. Mitchell couldn't use the goggles now, couldn't see the infrared glow of the hand warmers. He was bringing it in wide of the strip. The nose wheel caught in something, and the ultralight cartwheeled, crumpling, torn butterfly, and then lay down in its own white cloud of dust.
The flash of the explosion seemed to reach him an instant before the sound, throwing his shadow before him across the pale brush. The concussion picked him up and threw him down, and as he fell, he saw the broken surgery module in a ball of yellow flame, and knew that Weber had used her anti-tank rocket. Then he was up again, moving, running, the gun in his hand. He reached the wreckage of Mitchell's ultralight as the first flare died. Another one arced out of nowhere and blossomed overhead. The sound of firing was continuous now. He scrambled over a twisted sheet of rusted tin and found the sprawled figure of the pilot, head and face concealed by a makeshift helmet and a clumsy-looking goggle rig. The goggles were fastened to the helmet with dull silver strips of gaffer tape. The twisted limbs were padded in layers of dark clothing. Turner watched his hands claw at the tape, tear at the infrared goggles. His hands were distant creatures, pale undersea things that lived a life of their own, far down at the bottom of some unthinkable Pacific trench, and he watched as they tore frantically at tape, goggles, helmet, until it all came away, and the long brown hair, limp with sweat, fell across the girl's white face, smearing the thin trickle of dark blood that ran from one nostril, and her eyes opened, revealing empty whites, and he was tugging her up somehow into a fireman's carry, and reeling in what he hoped was the direction of the jet. He felt the second explosion through the soles of his deck shoes and saw the idiot grin on the lump of plastique that sat on Ramirez's cyberspace deck. There was no flash, only sound and the sting of concussion through the concrete of the lot. And then he was in the cockpit, breathing the new car smell of long-chain monomers, the familiar scent of newly minted technology, and the girl was behind him, an awkward doll, sprawled in the embrace of the G-web that Conroy had paid a San Diego arms dealer to install behind the pilot's web. The plane was quivering, a live thing, and as he squirmed deeper into his own web, he fumbled for the interface cable, found it, ripped the Microsoft from his socket, and slid the cable jack home. Knowledge lit him like an arcade game, and he surged forward with the plainness of the jet, feeling the flexible airframe reshape itself for jump-off, as the canopy whined smoothly down on its servos. The G-web ballooned around him, locking his limbs rigid, the gun still in his hand. Go, motherfucker! But the jet already knew, and G-force crushed him down into the dark. You lost consciousness, to smell like dust. She sprawled on the couch, the brown resting on her stomach, and stared into the box. It ached. It seemed to her that the construction evoked something perfectly, but it was an emotion that lacked a name. She ran her hand through the bright illusion, tracing the length of the fluted avian bone. She was certain that Virek had already assigned an ornithologist the task of identifying the bird from whose wing that bone had come. And it would be possible to date each object with the greatest precision, she supposed. Each tab of holofish also housed an extensive report on the known origin of each piece, but something in her had deliberately avoided these. It was sometimes best, when you came to the mystery that was art, to come as a child. The child saw things that were too evident, too obvious for the trained eye. She put the brown down on the low table beside the couch and crossed to Andrea's phone, intending to check the time. She was meeting Paco at 1:00, to discuss the mechanics of Alain's payment. Alain had told her he would phone her at Andrea's at 3:00. When she punched for the time service, an automatic recap of satellite news strobed across the screen. A JAL shuttle had disintegrated during re-entry over the Indian Ocean. Investigators from the Boston-Atlanta Metropolitan Axis had been called in to examine the site of a brutal and apparently pointless bombing in a drab New Jersey residential suburb. Militiamen were supervising the evacuation of the southern quadrant of New Bonn, following the discovery by construction workers of 2 undetonated wartime rockets believed to be armed with biological weapons. And official sources in Arizona were denying Mexico's accusation of the detonation of a small-scale atomic or nuclear device near the Sonora border. As she watched, the recap cycled and the simulation of the shuttle began its fire death again. She shook her head, tapping the button. It was noon. Summer had come, the sky hot and blue above Paris, and she smiled at the smell of good bread and black tobacco. Her sense of being observed had receded now, as she walked from the metro to the address Paco had given her. Faubourg Saint-Honoré. The address seemed vaguely familiar. A gallery, she thought. Yes, the Roberts. The owner, an American who operated 3 galleries in New York as well. Expensive, but no longer quite chic. Paco was waiting beside an enormous panel on which were layered, beneath a thick and uneven coat of varnish, hundreds of small square photographs, the kind produced by certain very old-fashioned machines in train stations and bus terminals. All of them seemed to be of young girls. Automatically, she noted the name of the artist and the work's title. Read us the book of the names of the dead. I suppose you understand this sort of thing, the Spaniard said glumly. He wore an expensive-looking blue suit cut in Parisian business style, a white broadcloth shirt, and a very English-looking tie, probably from Charvet. He didn't look at all like a waiter now. There was an Italian bag of black-ribbed rubber slung over his shoulder. What do you mean? She asked. Names of the dead. And he nodded in the direction of the panel. You were a dealer in these things. What don't you understand? I sometimes feel as though this culture is entirely a trick, a ruse. All my life I have served Señor, in one guise or another, you understand. And my work has not been without its satisfactions, moments of triumph. But never, when he involved me with this business of art, have I felt any satisfaction. He is wealth itself. The world is filled with objects of great beauty. And yet Señor pursues... He shrugged. You know what you like, then. She smiled at him. Why did you choose this gallery for our meeting? Señor's agent purchased one of the boxes here. Haven't you read the histories we provided you with in Brussels? No, she said. It might interfere with my intuition. Herr Viereck is paying for my intuition. He raised his eyebrows. I will introduce you to Picard, the manager. Perhaps he can do something for this intuition of yours. He led her across the room and through a doorway. A graying, heavy-set Frenchman in a rumpled corduroy suit was speaking into the handset of a phone. On the phone's screen she saw columns of letters and figures, the day's quotations on the New York market. Ah, the man said, Esteves, excuse me, only a moment. He smiled apologetically and returned to his conversation. Marley studied the quotations. Pollock was down again. This, she supposed, was the aspect of art that she had the most difficulty understanding. Picard, if that was the man's name, was speaking with a broker in New York, arranging the purchase of a certain number of points of the work of a particular artist. A point might be defined in any number of ways, depending on the medium involved, but it was almost certain that Picard would never see the works he was purchasing. If the artist enjoyed sufficient status, the originals were very likely crated away in some vault, where no one saw them at all. Days or years later, Picard might pick up that same phone and order the broker to sell. Marley's gallery had sold originals. There was relatively little money in it, but it had a certain visceral appeal. And of course, there had been the chance that one would get lucky. She had convinced herself that she'd gotten very lucky indeed, when Alain had arranged for the forged Cornell to surface as a wonderful accidental find. Cornell had his place on the broker's board, and his points were very expensive. Picard, Paco said, as though he were addressing a servant, this is Marley Krushkova. Señor has brought her into the matter of the anonymous boxes. She may wish to ask you questions. Charmed, Picard said, and smiled warmly, but she thought she detected a flicker in his brown eyes. Very likely he was trying to connect the name to some scandal, relatively recent. I understand that your gallery handled the transaction, then? Yes, Picard said. We had displayed the work in our New York rooms, and it had attracted a number of bids. We decided to give it its day in Paris, however. He beamed. And your employer made our decision most worthwhile. How is Herr Viereck, Esteves? We have not seen him in several weeks. Marley glanced quickly at Paco, but his dark face was smooth, utterly controlled.
Senor is very well, I would think, he said.
Excellent, said Picard, somewhat too enthusiastically. He turned to Marley. A marvelous man, a legend, a great patron, a great scholar.
Marley thought she heard Paco sigh. Could you tell me, please, where your New York branch obtained the work in question?
Picard's face fell. He looked at Paco, then back at Marley.
You don't know. They haven't told you.
Could you tell me, please?
No, Picard said. I'm sorry, but I can't. You see, we don't know.
Marley stared at him.
I beg your pardon, but I don't quite see how that is possible.
She hasn't read the report, Picard. You tell her. It will be good for her intuition to hear it from your own lips.
Picard gave Paco an odd look, then regained his composure.
Certainly, he said. A pleasure.
Do you think it's true?
She asked Paco as they stepped out into Faubourg Saint-Honoré and summer sunlight. The crowds were thick with Japanese tourists.
I went to the sprawl myself, Paco said, and interviewed everyone involved. Roberts left no record of the purchase, although ordinarily he was no more secretive than the next art dealer.
And his death was accidental?
He put on a pair of mirrored Porsche glasses.
As accidental as that sort of death ever is, he said. We have no way of knowing when or how he obtained the piece. We located it here 8 months ago, and all our attempts to work backward end with Roberts. And Roberts has been dead for a year.
Picard neglected to tell you that they very nearly lost the thing.
Roberts kept it in his country house, along with a number of other things that his survivors regarded as mere curiosities. The whole lot came close to being sold at public auction. Sometimes I wish it had been.
These other things, she asked, falling into step beside him. What are they?
He smiled. You think we haven't tracked them, each one?
We have.
They were... Here he frowned, exaggerating the effort of memory. A number of rather unremarkable examples of contemporary folk art.
Was Roberts known to be interested in that sort of thing?
No, he said. But approximately a year before his death, we know that he made application for membership in the Institut de l'Art Brut here in Paris, and arranged to become a patron of the Eichmann collection in Hamburg.
Marley nodded. The Eichmann collection was restricted to the works of psychotics.
We are reasonably certain, Paco continued, taking her elbow and guiding her around a corner into a side street, that he made no attempt to use the resources of either, unless he employed an intermediary, and we regard that as unlikely. Senor, of course, has employed several dozen scholars to sweep the records of both institutions. To no avail.
Tell me, she said, why Picard assumed that he had recently seen Herr Viereck. How is that possible?
Senor is wealthy. Senor enjoys any number of means of manifestation. Now he led her into a chrome-trimmed barn of a place, glittering with mirrors, bottles, and arcade games. The mirrors lied about the depth of the room. At its rear, she could see the reflected pavement, the legs of pedestrians, the flash of sunlight on a hubcap. Paco nodded to a lethargic-looking man behind the bar and took her hand, leading her through the tightly packed shoal of round plastic tables.
You can take your call from Alain here, he said. We have arranged to reroute it from your friend's apartment.
He drew a chair out for her, an automatic bit of professional courtesy that made her wonder if he might actually once have been a waiter, and placed his bag on the tabletop.
But he'll see that I'm not there, she said. If I blank the video, he'll become suspicious.
But he won't see that. We've generated a digital image of your face and the required background. We'll key that to the image on this phone. He took an elegant modular unit from the bag and placed it in front of her. A paper-thin polycarbon screen unfurled silently from the top of the unit and immediately grew rigid. She had once watched a butterfly emerge into the world and seen the transformation of its drying wings.
How is that done? She asked, tentatively touching the screen.
It was like thin steel.
One of the new polycarbon variants, he said. One of the mass products. The phone purred discreetly. He positioned it more carefully in front of her, stepped to the far side of the table, and said, "Your call. Remember, you are at home." He reached forward and brushed a titanium-coated stud. Alain's face and shoulders filled the little screen. The image had the smudged, badly lit look of a public booth. "Good afternoon, my dear," he said.
"Hello, Alain."
"How are you, Marley? I trust you've gotten the money we discussed?" She could see that he was wearing a jacket of some kind, dark, but she could make out no details. "Your roommate could do with a lesson in house cleaning," he said, and seemed to be peering back over her shoulder. "You've never cleaned a room in your life," she said. He shrugged, smiling. "We each have our talents," he said. "Do you have my money, Marley?" She glanced up at Paco, who nodded. "Yes," she said. "Of course." "That's wonderful, Marley. Marvelous. We have only one small difficulty." He was still smiling.
"And what is that?"
"My informants have doubled their price. Consequently, I must now double mine." Paco nodded. He was smiling, too. "Very well. I will have to ask, of course." He sickened her now. She wanted to be off the phone. "And they, of course, will agree."
"Where shall we meet, then?"
"I will phone again at 5, he said. His image shrank to a single blip of blue-green, and then that was gone as well. "You look tired," Paco said as he collapsed the screen and replaced the phone in his bag. "You look older when you've talked with him."
"Do I?"
For some reason now, she saw the panel in the Roberts, all those faces. "Read us the book of the names of the dead." All the Marleys, she thought. All the girls she'd been through the long season of youth. 16. Legba.
"Hey, shithead." Rhea poked him none too lightly in the ribs. "Get your ass up."
He came up fighting with the crocheted comforter, with the half-formed shapes of unknown enemies, with his mother's murderers. He was in a room he didn't know, a room that might have been anywhere. Gold plastic gilt frames on a lot of mirrors, fuzzy scarlet wallpaper. He'd seen Gothics decorate rooms that way, when they could afford it, but he'd also seen their parents do whole condos in the same style. Rhea flung a bundle of clothes down on the temper foam and shoved her hands in the pockets of a black leather jacket. The pink and black squares of the comforter were bunched around his waist. He looked down and saw the segmented length of the centipede submerged in a finger-wide track of fresh pink scar tissue. Beauvoir had said that the thing accelerated healing. He touched the bright new tissue with a hesitant fingertip, found it tender but bearable. He looked up at Rhea. "Get your ass up on this," he said, giving her the finger. They glared at each other for a few seconds over Bobby's upraised middle finger. Then she laughed.
"Okay," she said. "You got a point. I'll get off your case. But pick those clothes up and get them on. Should be something there that fits. Lucas is due by here soon to pick you up, and Lucas doesn't like to be kept waiting."
"Yeah? Well, he seems like a pretty relaxed guy to me." He began to sort through the heap of clothing, discarding a black shirt with a paisley pattern printed on it in laundered-out gold, a red satin number with a fringe of white imitation leather down the sleeves, a black sort of leotard thing with panels of some translucent material. "Hey," he said, "where did you get this stuff? I can't wear shit like this."
"It's my little brother's," Rhea said, "from last season, and you better get your white ass dressed before Lucas gets down here."
"Hey," she said, "that's mine," snatching up the leotard as though he might be about to steal it. He pulled the black and gold shirt on and fumbled with domed snaps made of black imitation pearl. He found a pair of black jeans, but they proved to be baggy and elaborately pleated, and didn't seem to have any pockets.
"This all the pants you got?"
"Jesus," she said. "I saw the clothes Pi cut off you, man.
You aren't anybody's idea of a fashion plate. Just get dressed, okay? I don't want any trouble with Lucas. He may come on all mellow with you, but that just means you got something he wants bad enough to take the trouble. Me, I sure don't, so Lucas got no compunctions as far as I'm concerned.
He stood up unsteadily beside the bed slab and tried to zip up the black jeans.
No zip, he said, looking at her.
Buttons, in there somewhere. It's part of the style, you know.
Bobby found the buttons. It was an elaborate arrangement, and he wondered what would happen if he had to piss in a hurry. He saw the black nylon thongs beside the slab and shoved his feet into them.
What about Jackie? He asked, padding to where he could see himself in the gold-framed mirrors.
Lucas got any compunctions about her?
He watched her in the mirror, saw something cross her face.
What's that mean?
Au revoir. He told me she was a horse.
You hush, she said, her voice gone low and urgent. Beauvoir mention anything like that to you, that's his business. Otherwise, it's nothing you talk about, understand? There's things bad enough you'd wish you were back out there getting your butt carved up.
He watched her eyes, reflected in the mirror, dark eyes shadowed by the deep brim of the soft felt hat. Now they seemed to show a little more white than they had before.
Okay, he said after a pause, and then added, thanks.
He fiddled with the collar of the shirt, turning it up in the back, down again, trying it different ways.
You know, Rhea said, tilting her head to one side, you get a few clothes on you, you don't look too bad. Except you got eyes like two piss holes in a snowbank.
Lucas, Bobby said when they were in the elevator, do you know who it was off my old lady? It wasn't a question he'd planned on asking, but somehow it had come rushing up like a bubble of swamp gas.
Lucas regarded him benignly, his long face smooth and black. His black suit, beautifully cut, looked as though it had been freshly pressed. He carried a stout stick of oiled and polished wood, the grain all swirly black and red, topped with a large knob of polished brass. Finger-long splines of brass ran down from the knob, inlaid smoothly in the cane's shaft.
No, we do not. His wide lips formed a straight and very serious line. That's something we'd very much like to know.
Bobby shifted uncomfortably.
The elevator made him self-conscious. It was the size of a small bus, and although it wasn't crowded, he was the only white. Black people, he noted, as his eyes shifted restlessly down the thing's length, didn't look half dead under fluorescent light, the way white people did. Three times in their descent, the elevator came to a halt at some floor and remained there, once for nearly 15 minutes. The first time this happened, Bobby had looked questioningly at Lucas.
Something in the shaft, Lucas had said.
What?
Another elevator.
The elevators were located at the core of the arcology, their shafts bundled together with water mains, sewage lines, huge power cables, and insulated pipes that Bobby assumed were part of the geothermal system that Beauvoir had described. You could see it all whenever the doors opened. Everything was exposed, raw, as though the people who built the place had wanted to be able to see exactly how everything worked and what was going where. And everything, every visible surface, was covered with an interlocking net of graffiti, so dense and heavily overlaid that it was almost impossible to pick out any kind of message or symbol.
You never were up here before, were you, Bobby? Lucas asked as the doors jolted shut once again and they were on their way down.
Bobby shook his head.
That's too bad, Lucas said.
Understandable, certainly, but kind of a shame. Two-a-day tells me you haven't been too keen on sitting around Berrytown.
That true?
Sure is, Bobby agreed.
I guess that's understandable, too.
You seem to me to be a young man of some imagination and initiative. Would you agree?
Lucas spun the cane's bright brass head against his pink palm and looked at Bobby steadily.
I guess so. I can't stand the place. Lately I've kind of been noticing how, well, nothing ever happens, you know. I mean, things happen, but it's always the same stuff, over and fucking over.
like it's all a rerun, every summer like the last one. His voice trailed off, uncertain what Lucas would think of him.
Yes, Lucas said. I know that feeling. It may be a little more true of Barrytown than of some other places, but you can feel the same thing as easily in New York or Tokyo.
Can't be true, Bobby thought, but nodded anyway. Rhea's warning in the back of his head. Lucas was no more threatening than Beauvoir, but his bulk alone was a caution. And Bobby was working on a new theory of personal deportment. He didn't quite have the whole thing yet, but part of it involved the idea that people who were genuinely dangerous might not need to exhibit the fact at all, and that the ability to conceal a threat made them even more dangerous.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.